History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories right there waiting to be told. All we have to do is ask a few questions and then take the time to patiently listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always come out better for it because we're educated. We're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'm not sure how you marked Thanksgiving this year. Chances are that in some way, maybe significant or maybe seemingly insignificant, but in some way, it was different from what Thanksgiving is usually like for you. Each and every year, there are families experiencing Thanksgiving without a certain loved one for the first time. I've been there, you probably have been too, and this year, so many of the amazing Americans you've heard on this show were absent from that Thanksgiving table for the first time. I don't always mention it on air when one of the veterans you've met here passes because typically we're spending the hour getting to know and celebrating a veteran who's still with us. But as I gathered with our family this year, I found myself thinking about some of those families, like the family of Joe Garabedian, who passed away this month at the age of 96. It was only a few months earlier that he had explained to us how close he came to losing his life in the Philippines 76 years earlier.
Zing, right through my shoulder. Mm-hmm. So it was a sniper. Later on at the Army reunions, one of the guys told me, he says, when they found the guy, they counted 60 shots. He was up in the palm tree.
Mm.
So I got up and I started running. I run about 10 feet. The blood is squirting out. I'm hollering, medics, medics. And I fell down. So my medic comes and, Garabedian, where's your medical kit? I says, it's on the Jeep. I said, I didn't want to carry it. So they gave me a shot of morphine. They patched me up. That's the only patching up I got until I got to Hoanya, New Guinea. So this is an interesting part. They managed to get me on a stretcher, and a fellow by the name of Medziak out of Chicago, he was underneath the bush. He reached down and grabbed a hold of my stretcher, and one hand pulled me underneath that bush. It took another half hour before the firing. You don't fire all day long. It just goes in spurts. So then at about 5:30 in the evening, the Jeep came by and they put three of us on and took us back 14 miles to the field hospital.
What about your arm? Did you have the use of that left arm at all?
I didn't have the use of that arm for more than a year. I was in the hospital. From that point on, I got discharged on November 45. We entered the United States and back again on the 2nd of January. Of 45. I got discharged. The end of 45, I got discharged.
Mm-hmm.
My arm was useless. Even now, when the weather gets real cold, this arm is useless because I got a 30% disability on it.
Well, it sounds almost miraculous you were ever able to use it at all.
I use it for everything.
But I'm thinking about the first 30 minutes that you're wounded, because you described it. They get you on a stretcher, but you're still out there, and they're still firing all around you, and, yeah. And your buddy's able to pull you under a bush.
I've often wondered how they got me on the stretcher, but Medziak was the only one under the bush within reach of me, and he pulled it underneath. I guess what happened was they spread out once they got me on the stretcher, and that stretcher is on legs or something, and he's a big, great big bullock, great big bullock. He grabbed me and pulled me underneath.
What do you think would have happened to you if he didn't do that?
They would have nailed me.
Not only did Joe Garabedian come home and overcome his injuries, he founded a welding and machine business with his brothers that endures today, with his children and grandchildren carrying on his legacy and producing custom machines for agricultural applications all around the world. I'm so thankful we got to hear Joe's amazing story when we did. And so was the daughter of that fellow wounded soldier who saved Joe's life in 1944 by pulling him under the bush for cover. Tony Medziak never told his daughter anything about how he was wounded, but in listening to Joe's memories, she received details she never would have been able to learn otherwise. The day after we lost Joe Garabedian this month, Lou Goodman passed away in San Luis Obispo, California, where he had become a fixture at the Spirit of San Luis restaurant at the airport there, treating friends and sometimes strangers to breakfast every weekend. Lou was a bombardier on B-17s with the 91st Bomb Group during World War II, and he shared one memory of his plane being shot up, two crew members severely wounded, the navigator informing the crew that they had two options, ditch in the English Channel or try to make it back to their base, even though they might not be able to muster enough altitude to clear those white cliffs of Dover.
Took a vote. It was unanimous. We're going to stick together one way or another. We're going to make it or not make it, but we're not going to ditch it in that cold channel. We're not going to lose those two guys for sure.
Right.
So as it turned out, those two guys...
Yeah.
Went to the hospital. They never came back to the war, but they both lived. They both lived. And but if we had a ditch in that channel, they wouldn't have lived.
So that was really the decision point.
Yeah.
Because you guys can ditch in the channel. You know the water's cold.
Very cold.
You don't know how long it's going to take for someone to find you.
Right.
And because of their injuries, you guys were convinced they wouldn't survive.
They wouldn't survive. They won't survive in that cold water. And they couldn't help themselves. They were unconscious, you know. So he said they won't make it.
So the other eight of you risked your lives.
We voted.
You voted, and your decision was basically to risk your lives on the chance that you might not make it over the cliffs in order to save those two.
We could have died there, too. But we elected, you know, and all eight guys... Start praying. All eight guys start praying. That's why, not only my mother's prayers, but other places, I am a strong believer in prayer.
Anyone who met Lou in recent years heard similar things. In fact, Marshall Humes, the retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel who introduced me to Lou, shared that the last thing Lou said to him the night before he passed this month at the age of 96 was, quote, never underestimate the power of prayer. You can link to the complete interviews with Lou Goodman and Joe Garabedian at hometownheroesradio.com. And you can also access our conversation with Frank Macon. It made national headlines this week when Frank passed away at the age of 97 in his native Colorado Springs, Colorado. Frank Macon was one of the last surviving Tuskegee airmen from World War II. I want you to hear some of his story today, and the book that he wrote 2 years ago might be a perfect Christmas gift for someone in your life, not to mention a fitting way to perpetuate his unique legacy.
I was raised by two great aunts and an uncle. It was really great. I had a lot of fun and got into a lot of mischief, just like all the rest of the kids in the neighborhood. In fact, the book was written about some of the kids, and I always say that in the neighborhood, and I sit on the porch and I just told them they shouldn't do those things. But I got blamed for everything that happened in the neighborhood. There was a thing that the people in the neighborhood said, that boy, Ms. Macon's, will never live to be 21 because of the mischief that he's getting and the things that he was doing. And I fooled him. The neighborhood that I grew up in, it was very diverse as far as racial comes. There were Mexicans and very, very, very few blacks or colored or Negro or however they termed us in those days. And a lot of whites and everybody was of a lower middle class. And they all had to work. And there were gold miners and coal miners and ranchers, all of that. And that's who I grew up around. And people that were very innovative because the Depression was on, you know. Mm-hmm. And we had to forge for ourselves. And they did very well.
Well, and I've talked to a lot of people who lived through the Depression and the perspective that they have as a result. But I'm just trying to imagine where we are back in those days, because you're right by Interstate 25, but that wasn't here yet.
The highway to Denver was just a two-lane road, and part of it was paved and part of it wasn't.
Well, and I'm just imagining, I mean, the stories you hear about the Depression, people have a hard time finding enough food to eat, let alone gas for a car. And in this part of the country, at this altitude, you get a heck of a lot of snow. That couldn't have been easy to deal with in those days.
Well, yeah, but we survived, and everybody depended on everybody. In the fall of the year, they went deer hunting. The kids in the neighborhood, they would hang the carcasses up, and They would skin them, and we would have to scrape the hides. They would sell them for a whopping $5 a piece. And if you planted a garden, most of the neighborhood went with pitchforks and helped you dig up and plant the garden, and then you'd help the next one. So there was a lot of cooperation. We didn't see, as they have now, people standing on the corners with signs that please help. We took care of each other. Of course, they had things like the government finally came up with programs to put people to work, WPA and things like that. In 1935, around Labor Day, we had a flood that took out a lot of the neighborhood, and the creek that caused all the problems, they got out and widened it. And it was basically done by hand, so to speak. A drawbar with hooked to horses and things like that. And we widened the creek and put, if you see alongside the embankment, they've got rock. And all this was done up in the mountains. They built new reservoirs and highways and things like that. And people actually went to work. They just were not laying around asking somebody to take care of them or the government or anything like that. They were just used to doing that.
And I understand you became interested in aviation at a very young age. Is that right?
Oh, yes. There was an aircraft factory that was up in the north end of town, and it was called Alexander Aircraft. They built the Eagle Rock and the Eagle Rock Bullet. Every chance I could get, I'd sneak up there and watch them build the airplanes. And the factory finally had to shut down because of the Depression. But they had the airfield up, and they would take the aircraft across the road, which was the highway, over there to the little airfield, and they would do some testing and flying them. And, some of the airplanes were successful, and they had a little problems with some of the others.
Yeah, I think people forget how primitive aviation was then. I mean, you're only a couple decades into the existence of aircraft. But so that young, you dreamed of being a pilot someday?
Well, yes, and they would take me flying, and they saw that I had expressed a great interest in the aircraft, but it was the mechanics of the aircraft that I was interested in, as well as the flying.
So what was the first aircraft you ever went up in, and what did that feel like?
Well, as I stated in the book, there was a family that lived, the Warden family that lived next door to me, and they had been ranchers and they had moved to town. And there was two girls there, and these girls were dating some of the pilots up there. And when my folks had to go to work or something, well, they would babysit me, and they would just take me out there at the airport with them, and I was sitting up there flying with them. And I didn't realize, you know, no big deal. And so I got to very early age. And then, of course, I was trying to build my own wings and jumped off the chicken house and trying to fly. And I didn't have very successful landings.
I was going to say, how did that work when you jumped off the chicken coop?
Not very successful. It's a good thing the ground was plowed underneath.
And that little airfield you're talking about, where you got your first taste of flying, I believe they're still using that area for aviation today, maybe a different scale a little bit?
Yeah, that's where the Air Force Academy teaches their glider pilots. It was called Pine Valley Airport. They're going to rename it to Benjamin Davis Field. And, of course, as a Tuskegee Airman, we go out and talk to the cadets a lot, and I tell them this is where I made my first successful solo in high school is off this field.
And for people who aren't familiar, you're very familiar with the name that you just said, Benjamin Davis. But for people who don't know who that is, why don't you explain his significance?
This Benjamin Davis was the, his father was one of the first black generals. And, of course, he went to West Point And then there's quite a story about him and how they didn't talk to him the whole time he was there. But anyway, then he took over and learned to fly. And with when they started teaching the black pilots to fly, it's quite a story about how that all came about. And most of the military didn't want Roosevelt to authorize the service. And Mrs. Roosevelt, she pushed for him to do it. And I called her the mother of black aviation because she really forced it. And then she went down and flew with one of the pilots down there at Tuskegee. And it's quite a story. You could read about it. Pappy Anderson, as we called him, and she flew with him. And then she come back. And the Secret Service didn't want her to do it, and then called him and tried. And he said, "Well, I can't tell her anything. And she's going to do it. She's going to do it." So, that was that. You know, of course, the success that Tuskegee Airmen had overseas was is well documented.
Yes, of course. Books, documentaries, the feature film Red Tails that you may have seen. There's a wealth of material chronicling the contributions of the Tuskegee Airmen during World War II. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, I have linked for you an article from the FDR Library about Eleanor Roosevelt's early support for African-American aviation. And to elaborate on Frank's comments about General Benjamin O. Davis, Jr., the man for whom the airstrip where Frank Macon first flew is named, Davis was the leader of the Tuskegee Airmen in World War II, commanding the 332nd Fighter Group and personally flying 60 missions in P-39s, P-40s, P-47s, and P-51s. There's no shortage of heroics from those pioneering pilots, of course, but Davis took great pride in the spotless record of Red Tail escorts. Not a single bomber was ever lost when being escorted by the Tuskegee Airmen over more than 200 missions in the skies over Europe. Eventually, Davis would become the first African-American general in the history of the Air Force. He's buried at Arlington National Cemetery. A barracks is named in his honor at West Point, where, as Frank mentioned, Davis was once ostracized for the color of his skin. Davis passed away in 2002, but his autobiography is a great read. It's titled Benjamin O. Davis, Jr., American. It underscores his desire to be measured by his character and what he accomplished, to succeed as an American, as the book's jacket states, and not to fail because of color. So you might want to add that book to your list, along with Frank Macon's book, I Wanted to Be a Pilot. It's linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we're going to hear more of the story in the book and more of the story behind the book when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.